Thank you very much, everybody, and thank you, Piers, for sorting out the mic. Can I just say what a privilege it is to be back here at Shrymont addressing this diocese. I'm canonically resident in this diocese, and it's a privilege to be so, and I'm very proud to be a priest in the Episcopal Church. I do think this is a healthy province within the Anglican Communion in all sorts of ways, and some of the quaint traditions the Bishop alluded to in Britain perhaps can learn a little bit from the transparency and inclusion of the American Church. We're going to sing a hymn in a moment, just to prepare you. We're going to sing hymn 420. But before we do that, as I was driving up here, I found myself both listening to the news and reflecting on the continuing turmoil in the stock markets. And although that isn't the theme of what we're going to look at over the next few days, I thought that it would be appropriate just to pause and reflect on that and make that a matter of our prayer and concern as people who are leading congregations, leading parishes, and trying to determine the way forward. And I haven't got much to say. I mean, I've been reading up a little bit about it only because I'm doing a course next semester on Christianity in the public square, so I thought I would focus on economics. And I thought I would just give you a two-minute potted summary of what I think is going on insofar as I can judge. And I do so nervously because as I'm getting to know you all, I'm very aware that there are people with training in economics and a background in finance in this room. So please put me right afterwards. But exercising speaker's prerogative, I will sketch out the picture as I understand it. I mean, this is a very interesting time in world history. How significant it is, we just can't tell. It does have its roots in the subprime mortgage fiasco, as it proved to be, initially motivated perhaps by opening up mortgages to a wider spectrum of the population. But of course, as you'll recollect, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, you had all those adverts and all those mailings. Americans don't say adverts, do they? Thank you very much. All those ads, which actually talked a little bit about cut your mortgage in half. And what we now know is significant numbers of people, especially as it happens, minorities, who actually had regular mortgages, were persuaded to move to one of these new products, many of which guaranteed a low interest rate for 3 years, and then a dramatic hike in your mortgage repayments. And the assumption by mortgage brokers was that you saw increasing house market values, which meant that chances are you'll be able to remortgage and everything would be all right. That, of course, didn't happen, partly because housing prices in the US, as a norm since the Second World War, only really go up with the rate of inflation. The dramatic increases of the 90s are very atypical. And so perhaps it was always inevitable the housing market was going to correct itself. It did so. And at that point, of course, the first victims were lots of people who had their homes repossessed and found themselves in neighborhoods where many homes were repossessed and in real trouble. Well, then you've got banks carrying bad debt. And because they've been bundled in very imaginative ways and sold in a variety to a variety of financial institutions, and because Lehman's went under, you saw then the turmoil becoming affecting financial institutions. And of course, that precious commodity called trust broke down completely between financial institutions. And hence, we have the credit squeeze where money's no longer passing between financial institutions, partly justified with the major casualty of all this, which was Lehman's, as that went bankrupt. So you have a situation where just at the minute, you have so far two victims, really. The first set of victims were all those who had homes and no longer had them. And then the second set of victims are all those now who are looking at We're probably on the economic cycle of a recession anyway. So you had all those factors coupled with the credit freeze in financial institutions, and you've then seen the dramatic 40% devaluation in the stock market, which was very rapid and very dramatic. So the second set of victims are going to be people who are retired, dependent upon investment income for their livelihood. And that is many of your, some of your parishioners. And I do think we need to be prayerful and aware of the depth of the anxiety that those families will be facing. And then, of course, the third set of victims are going to be any institution, the Diocese of Virginia, for example, the pension fund. And, of course, those of you who are blessed with endowments now have smaller ones, and we'll have to think imaginatively about an operating budget with less income from that endowment. And Virginia Theological Seminary is in one of those institutions. And, of course, that does mean that that perhaps what we need to learn from all this is, first of all, do take an interest in this stuff and do seek to understand it a little. Second, reach out pastorally to those lives most affected. Third, it is one of those salutary moments when you recognize that everything really is ephemeral. And the besetting sin of the middle classes is that somehow we can be immune to those forces that affect the rest of the world. We are reminded that in a very real sense, everything changes. There is nothing secure. And our foundation needs to be grounded in the God revealed in Christ. And there, perhaps, in this moment, it will be one of those occasions when, as we lead congregations, we can invite them to sort of focus on what really matters, remind them again of the precious nature of relationships, taking a walk instead of spending money out at a fancy restaurant, coming to Shrine Mont instead of going to the Bahamas, and sort of simplifying one's lifestyle so you can really spend time with that which really matters. And as you one's aware of things that you wish you could do but no longer might not be able to do the exercise of reflecting on how much we've been given and find ways through it all and support each other through it. And of course, that then is a good segue into the theme of worship. But before I move to it, I was very aware that, you know, these events do bring out humor. And so I was reassured. My brothers, both my brothers, are in the financial sector in London. So I was very reassured to hear them cracking jokes at the as the stock market plummeted. And I think my favorite two are what's the definition of optimism? It's an investment banker ironing five shirts on a Sunday night. And then the second is what's the difference between a pigeon and an investment banker? A pigeon can still put a deposit on a Ferrari. And that capacity to find humor in all this is actually a gift of grace. So with that thought, let's sing hymn 420, When in Our Music God is Glorified.
I want to tell you a little bit about the creation of this hymn, which has become extraordinarily well-known and loved across the world. The tune is called Engelberg, and it was written by one of England's finest composers at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, Charles Villiers Stanford, and some magnificent music for the church. And he wrote this tune to appear in a great English hymnal called Hymns Ancient and Modern, and it was intended for use with For All the Saints. And short while later, a young man by the name of Ralph Vaughan Williams came on the scene to edit a book called The English Hymnal, and for all the saints, he wrote a tune called Sine Domine, and Engelberg died on the vine. It never really got used. It appeared in the hymnal 1940. I don't think anyone ever sang it. But along came a more contemporary editor of a hymnal and spoke to a marvelous Methodist, retired Methodist minister, F. Pratt Green, a delightful man. And Fred had a marvelous sense of humor. He was always adamant that he wanted to be known as Fred Pratt Green because he was afraid he would be known as F. P. Green. So he wrote this tune, this text to go to this tune, and the end result is that Engelberg has a new life, and it appears in the hymnal three times, and we sing it often. And for variety's sake, and this is such a wonderful sound, I would like us to sing 1, 3, and 5, everyone. I'd like everyone on this side to sing stanza 2, and we'll reflect on it as they sing. And then if you would sing stanza 4, and they'll ask them to reflect as you sing. So 1, 3, and 5, everyone, 2 here, 4 there.
My theme for the next few days is the theme of worship, liturgy, and love. And the title for the opening talk is Worship, the Purpose for Being. And at the end of the evening, there are copies of my outline, so you can take them away if you wish. Don't feel obliged, just feel free to leave it. But for those of you who like to take notes, there are the notes from which I'm speaking from available at the end. Worship is the recognition that we're created and intended to live in appropriate relationship with our Creator. Worship assumes that we're intended. It's a great dignifying act of being human that we're invited to worship God, that we're invited to acknowledge that reality on which we depend for our being, and we're invited to be in conversation, relating, loving the Creator. It is a great privilege. In fact, in a funny sort of way, it sounds a bit remarkable that it's true. And what I mean by that is that for the last 300 years, people have been very fixated on the size of the universe and the almost hubris of imagining that given the vastness of this universe, God could really care about you and me. And it's certainly true. If you think about how big this universe is, it's all a bit shocking. So let's just remind ourselves for a moment. Of course, when you talk about the universe, you've got to talk about it in terms of the speed of light, which, just to remind you, travels at approximately 186,000 miles a second, which is jolly fast. It means that if you travel around the Earth at the speed of light, in 1 second you will get around the Earth 7.5 times. And in 1 year, light travels, and this is jolly tricky to say, 5,878 billion, 625,000,000, 373,000, and 183 miles, which is a long way. Now, just to give you a sense of the scale of the universe, let's reduce the entire world, let's reduce our sun by 10 billion times. If I had a pinhead, that would be the size of this world. Okay, so it's small. And then 16 yards away would be a grapefruit. So approximately what, from here to one of those tables up there would be a grapefruit, and that would be our sun. Now, the nearest star on this scale is 4.3 light years away, And that is a total of 2,485 miles. So in other words, the sun's our star, about there, on that table there perhaps. If you go to California, that's the next nearest star. The Milky Way has a galaxy, is about 500 billion such stars, and a diameter in the region of 80,000 to 100,000 light years across. Now, our galaxy is part of a local group of galaxies known as a supercluster, and there are 10 million superclusters in this universe. This is a big universe, and we are jolly small. Now, of course, for centuries, critics of Christianity had enormous fun. I mean, what is the point of imagining that we puny people can claim some sort of relationship with the creator of this vastness? What is the point of imagining that we really believe that the creator of all this has become human, taken our form, and lived on earth? And for centuries, they sort of pushed back, and they ridiculed, and they implied that Christianity was deeply misguided, and it was all very, very implausible. And then it was in 1970. A very neglected branch of physics until relatively recently, and especially the work of Brandon Carter is hugely important in all this, when a discovery was made. Brandon Carter drew attention to the remarkable maths underpinning this universe. And he coined the expression anthropic principle. Probably not the best word to use, actually. But what he meant by this was this. He was drawing attention to the fact that the maths of this universe is so remarkable, it looks as if life in this universe was always intended. Now, so you're clear, this is nothing to do with intelligent design. This is nothing to do with anything of that nature. This is, even Richard Dawkins in The God Delusion devotes a whole section to the anthropic principle. He concedes the results that are emerging from contemporary astrophysicists. And the picture is this, that all this space in this vast universe was an essential precondition to enable you and me to be. And if all this space wasn't there, and if it wasn't precisely balanced in the way that it is, we would never have been. In other words, we live in what's called a bio-friendly universe, a universe which seemed to intend life to come forward. And there are about 30 variables, 30 or so, that if they weren't just right, we would have just been swirling gases, planets would never have formed, stars would never have exploded, carbon would never have been. I'll give you one illustration. As you all know, at the Big Bang, you've got the explosive vigor going one way, the expanding tendency of the universe. You've also got simultaneously the gravitational tendency of the universe. To enable planets to form, that had to be in exact, precise balance. And what's interesting is the matching at the Big Bang between those two tendencies are a staggering 1 part to 10 to the 60. Now, for those of you who can't remember this sort of stuff, let me just tell you what that sort of means. In other words, if it just varied a minuscule, a minute minuscule, then planets would never have formed. It had to be precisely balanced between those two enormous forcing. 10 to the 60 would be equivalent to taking a bow and arrow, aiming at a target the other side of the observable universe and hitting it. It is that sort of number we're talking about. So suddenly, in the last 20 years, 30 years, a criticism Christianity had to cope with dissipates. People are now conceding that is not just that variable which is remarkable, but about 30 of them, and all of them could have easily been otherwise. It's really puzzling why it worked out. In fact, the major alternative hypothesis is what's called the multiverse theory, which says there are thousands and billions of vast universes, much the same size as ours, which didn't manage to enable life and planets to emerge. That's the primary alternative out there. It's the one Richard Dawkins goes for. Now, it would be analogous, if you like, to get a sense of what's happening here. It would be analogous as if you turned up to a hotel one evening. And as you walked into the room, you know, you get your key, you walk into the room, and you suddenly notice above the fireplace your favorite picture. And then as you listen, you notice the music being played on the audio system. And now, with your senses all alert, you sort of find yourself rummaging in the refrigerator, and you find, sure enough, all your favorite candy and all your favorite drinks. And you walk into the bathroom, and there are all your favorite lotions and shampoos. And then you find yourself sitting down and saying, look, it looks like somebody knew I was coming. It looks fixed. It looks like this room was intended to me. And it isn't just chance that of billions of rooms, I just happen to be in the right one. Christians, for the first time, really, have a clear response to why the universe had to be so big. And the clear response is this: to enable people such as us to emerge, it had to be precisely this size. And if it was slightly older or younger or bigger or larger, size and age are the same thing, we would never have been. And the Christian explanation is not to postulate a highly unscientific hypothesis of multiverses, because of course you'll never know they're there. But the Christian response is to say we're in a universe which intended us to be. Intended creatures of complexity to emerge who can have a relationship with God, who can learn to worship God, on whom they are dependent for their being. This is the reason why the universe is like this. And suddenly the world changes and we look at it in a different way. We are in this universe because we're intended. We're in this universe because we're here for a purpose. That purpose is to worship God and discover the centrality of love, to overcome destructive egotistical tendencies within us, and learn to relate both to others and to God. That's the privilege of being. That's why we're here. Now, worship involves giving God due worth. There is another criticism made of worship, and that is that it sounds a little odd sometimes. And this is a criticism you can find in Nietzsche, or Nietzsche, as Americans like to say. And you also find it in Freud, and you find it in Feuerbacher and other writers. And that is that worship is, you know, what sort of being is it? Creates a universe and enables people to emerge and then insists that they spend their time worshiping God. Isn't that sort of like the insecure male middle manager in a big corporation who constantly needs reassurance from people around him? And it's almost always a him, because men are much more insecure than women. And constantly have to surround themselves with acolytes and people who are fawning and reassuring them that they've had such a great idea and what a good approach and how fabulous they are and what great leadership qualities they're demonstrating. Isn't it a bit like that? Rush Rees, the Welsh philosopher, put it this way: if my first and chief reason for worshipping God had to be a belief that a super Frankenstein would blast me to hell if I did not, then I hope I should have the decency to tell this being who is named Almighty God to go ahead and blast. And what Rush Rees is getting at there is he says, look, I'm not sure if I like the idea of God creating us to spend all our time saying how great God is, how loving God is, how good God is. What an odd thing for God to require us to do. So that's the objection that he's at. Now, of course, this is where your concept of God is very, very important if you're going to properly understand worship. We worship a God that's personal, but not a person. The doctrine of divine simplicity, just to remind you all, is precisely the reason why we don't believe God has a body. God's not corporeal. God's incorporeal. God's spirit. So God is personal in the sense that God is an agent and has consciousness, but isn't an ego. God doesn't need to be constantly reassured by us. That's not what worship's all about. Instead, worship is the act of acknowledging who God is. Worship is acknowledging our dependence on the Creator for the privilege of breathing, feeling, touching, looking, seeing, loving, simply every moment, every second. Worship is acknowledging that all that is made possible by a God who is the sustainer and enabler of everything that is. Worship is the act of seeing in God those qualities of love and goodness and acknowledging those qualities of love in goodness in God. So we worship as a way of centering ourselves in the divine, as a way of locating ourselves in the divine, as a way of making sure we root ourselves in that which is essential for our very being. And therefore, worship involves a recognition of the objective nature of the moral life. Of course, there's a big debate in ethics about what exactly moral behavior is and where do our morals and ethics come from. And to crudely oversimplify a complex debate, there are broadly two options. One which locates ethical life in culture, in individual judgment, therefore different cultures will have different sets of values and grounds it there. And the other which says no, there is built into moral language a transcendent and universal dynamic to language, to moral language, which proves that it's grounded in the transcendent. So two contrasting locations, one which places it firmly here with us, with cultures, with individual judgment, and one which grounds it in the transcendent. It's interesting how, if you look at moral language, it definitely emerged assuming the latter. So, for example, I went to my son's first home football game, and by that I really do mean that game Americans play. You know, where you throw the ball around instead of using your feet. I've always been puzzled why it's called football, but I won't go there. And of course, I made the mistake of not finding out what his number was. So, of course, I spent the entire time watching the wrong child. But my wife sat me down that lunchtime and said, Ian, look, if you can come, you really ought to come. You really ought to come. Now, of course, I was thinking, well, I'd much rather sit in yet another meeting and discuss the future of our endowment. But the word ought is always used when you conflict with what you would like to do. I'd rather go out to a bar, or I'd rather go and watch the Redskins play. But, oh, no, I really ought to go and see my son play in his seventh grade football game. Which they lost, incidentally. They were absolutely trounced. So you can sort of feel that when you use moral language, the sense of ought, something is external bearing down on you. Ought is always used in that way. It has an external transcendent quality. You don't use the word ought when you mean want. You know, you just say, I want to do something. But you use the word ought, I really ought to go and visit that parishioner, even though, to tell you the truth, I really could do with the opportunity to just sit down and have a cup of tea or whatever. So you use the word ought when you've got that external transcendent quality. And, of course, the other dynamic to moral language is that it's universal. So when you say that something's right, slavery's wrong, for example, that is a universal claim. You don't say, well, for some cultures it's okay, but for my culture it's wrong. You mean, no, it's universally mistaken. It's a grave sin. So moral language assumes a transcendent focus and location. When you worship, a primary duty and obligation in the act of worship is not simply to recognize the gift of worship, the fact that we're intended and we are being invited by God to acknowledge that transcendent reality, not simply to enjoy the fact that we see in God everything that ultimately matters, but also live out of that place of what ultimately matters and be the person God's called us to be. Let me explain what I mean by that. A primary purpose of worship is to sort out your value hierarchy. So, for example, there are lots of things I like doing. I quite like doing video games, and I was confessing to my Fresh Start group that I'm in the middle of doing the Da Vinci Code on the PlayStation, and I'm still stuck in the bathrooms in the Louvre. But it's something I enjoy doing, and it's something that my son and I can talk to each other about. So that's one of my values in my life. You know, I enjoy doing video games. I think they were a good invention. I like gadgets. But, of course, that's less important than the sense of call that I have as the Dean and President of Virginia Theological Seminary, as a priest, and with it those responsibilities that are part of that ministry. So if ever I've got a choice between shall I do the next segment of the Da Vinci Code on the PlayStation 2, or should I do something related to my ministry trumps my passion for video games, okay? Because that's appropriately ordering my values. And of course, my duties as the Dean and President of VTS also can be trumped on occasions, because I have primary obligations to a son and to a wife and to family and to certain key relationships which trump even my obligations as an employee, as a servant of the board of VTS. So we have, all of us, a value hierarchy. The question is, where does that value hierarchy come from? Is it just a cultural construct, or is it grounded and transcendent? And in the act of worship, when we name God, when we recognize in God love, when we recognize in God justice, when we recognize in God who God is, so we start to reflect on the values in our own lives. So we start sorting out what really matters at that place. So one way you can look at what the prophet Amos is going on about in Amos chapter 5, one way you can look at that is Amos is saying, look, you spend your time worshiping God, but you just don't get it. You don't sort out what really matters. You don't orientate your values accordingly. I mean, Amos 5 verse 21 reads, I despise your festivals, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the offerings of well-being of your fatted animals, I will not look upon. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps. But let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. In other words, you can't worship God and oppress your neighbor. You can't worship God and behave in unjust ways in the world the rest of the week. You can't worship God and gossip. You can't worship God and destroy human relationships. You can't worship God and live in disordered, unbalanced ways. In the very act of worship, in the very act of recognizing who God is, one starts to sort out who we are called to be. You start to sort out what really matters. You start to reflect on your value hierarchy. One purpose of the privilege of worshiping God is that you start recognizing what really matters. You start to see that things matter less than relationships. You start to see that, sure, yeah, in a very real sense, my son's football team game matters more than that meeting that perhaps I needed to go to. You start to see that the importance of placing the values embodied in the life of God first, seeking the kingdom first, you start to see all this matters, and you start to live a life transformed as a result. So the picture I'm sketching as an introduction to the meditations over the next few days is a picture which says worship is the reason why we are. And worship and all that involves. And what we need to get away from is a picture of worshipping a big invisible person in the sky and telling that big impersonal ego how good and great he is. That's the wrong image entirely. What you want to see is that worship is first and foremost done because it's recognizing a metaphysical reality that's true of each and every one of us. That we cannot be except because we're enabled by God. Because we're enabled by the Creator to be, that enables us to exist, to function. And that act of worship is the act of recognizing that dependence. Worship is giving God due worth. Giving God worth for who God is. That Creator, who in God's nature is revealed in Jesus of Nazareth, loves, is just, compassionate and merciful, and calls us all into a relationship with God. And as we do all this, we start sorting out our values. Worship is a very practical activity. We start to recognize as we converse with God who we are and what we're called to be and how we should be. So, worship assumes we're intended. Worship involves giving to God due worth, and worship involves a recognition of the objective nature of the moral life. We're going to conclude our meditation, except we're going to go straight into Compline, aren't we? That's the plan. If that's all right, we're going to conclude our meditation with hymn 300. And I'll just check with Ray whether there's anything you want to say about this. So hymn number 300. I've got a request for questions. I'll take a question. Yes, please. I think perhaps you and I might need a longer conversation because I would need to unpack with you exactly where you're coming from. Well, just briefly. Yeah, it does. And we can talk further about this afterwards. But just briefly, these are good questions to ask. Right, that's the first thing I want to say, because I do think that given that the work of parish ministry is partly being a worship leader, is partly leading the people in the work of liturgy, literally the work of the people, to worship God, given that that's a primary aspect, one of our primary obligations, it is worth being clear about what we're doing and what exactly we believe is the relationship of the creation to the Creator, and how we think about all those things. Now, the questions you're asking, actually, there's a huge literature and a whole spectrum of possible options there. Let me just give you my own personal view, which is influenced in part by Whitehead and others. I would take the view that in the life of God, there is time. So in there is, if you like, God's own time. There is duration. And God always was, and God always will be. And in that, there is time passing. Now, of course, in the act of creation, you have created times emerge. Because, of course, one thing we all learned from Einstein is that there is a complicated relationship between time and space. So you had numerous times emerge, of which God is in some sort of relationship and embraces. So the creator embraces all the times within the space-time continuum of creation. And therefore, when we worship, that act is a way of enabling us to center ourselves in such a way that we connect to the time of the triune God from the time we're in. And that's how it's made possible. Okay, well, on that dense thought, let's move to hymn, but thank you for the question. Let's move to hymn 300, Glory, Love and Praise and Honor.